I'd like to call this meeting of the Energy Policy Committee to order. Our first order of business is House File 337, Representative Lilly. And I will move that Representative Lilly's bill, House File 337, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Tax Committee. Representative Lilly has an author's amendment. I would move his author's amendment to get the bill in the shape he would like. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. I should note for the record, we have a quorum is present, and a quorum was present when we moved the bill and when we adopted the amendment. Representative Lilly. Good morning. Good afternoon.
I know. I was wondering myself there for a second.
Welcome to the Energy Policy Committee.
Thank you for having us, Madam Chair and members and esteemed staff, Ms. Faust and Peter. Where were we at hockey last night? Sorry, a little casualness. Probably not good. Madam Chair and members, House File 337 is an attempt to ask for a personal property tax exemption for new electric generation equipment that would be installed by a municipal power utility that is covered by the great cities of North St. Paul and Chaska, and one of the best cities in the state, Shakopee, and Anoka. anyways, we have a joint powers agreement that is currently producing energy, and we're hoping to have an exemption for this new facility that is going to be built. With me today, I have some smart people, and they can answer some questions. I don't know exactly what you'd like, but maybe I'll start with Ms. Darlene, and she could kind of give you the real details of what we're trying to do here. And that's okay.
That sounds good, Representative Lilly. And to the witness, if you can just say your first and last name and then tell us who you're with for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kelsey Dahlin. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. I'm with Avant Energy Services out of Minneapolis. The Minnesota Municipal Power Agency is an agency comprised of 11 member communities. Those include Anoka, Arlington, Brownton, Buffalo, Chaska, East Grand Forks, Le Sueur, North St. Paul, Olivia, Shakopee, and Winthrop. The agency provides wholesale power to its 11 member communities, and those member municipals then sell retail power to their customers. Mm-hmm. We're here today to speak to you about a distributed generation program, which we are seeking this legislation for. MMPA believes that a program which would locate generation resources at load would be beneficial to the agency and would keep us competitive with the other power suppliers in the state of Minnesota. In general, this program would utilize natural gas reciprocating engines that would be located next to a member community's substations and would supply power directly to the customers within the member community. The benefits of this are broken down into two primary categories, transmission benefits as well as economic benefits. The transmission benefits of this program primarily are that transmission requirements in the state of Minnesota are at a place right now that it's a pretty lengthy process to get additional transmission for resources. This process for locating resources at the load doesn't have those same transmission requirements. And so there are some efficiencies associated with that from a planning standpoint. In addition, the program would also enable MMPA to have a more efficient use of the power that they're generated, generating because the power, as it goes over the transmission lines, a fair amount of it gets lost. And so locating these resources at the load, only using then the low voltage transmission lines, would be more efficient in general. This type of generation also has the potential to reduce costs to our members and boost economic development because we then also wouldn't be paying for that transmission services to send it over those lines. In addition, this program has some reliability benefits to our members. So if, for instance, a transmission line went down, we would have generation located in the community, and so businesses and customers in that community wouldn't be as likely to lose power. I also just wanted to state that, you know, in general, this doesn't have an impact on the proposed state budget, as these facilities have not yet been constructed and would not be constructed if this legislation does not go through. The four communities that we are proposing to put these facilities in are the communities of Anoka, Chaska, North St. Paul, and Shakopee. And the reason these communities are especially suitable for this type of generation is that they have loads that are sizable enough to locate these facilities and size them appropriately. And they also have a natural gas supply within the community. So if it's all right, Madam Chair, I would also like our Representative John Crooks to speak a few words, if that's all right with you.
That'd be great. Mr. Crooks, if you can say your name for the record and who you're with, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Crooks. I'm Utilities Manager with Shakopee Public Utilities. We're municipal utilities, which means we're locally owned and locally controlled. It's benefits to this type of power as opposed to the IOUs. We see this as a fantastic opportunity for the member communities of MMPA and also for the city of Shakopee and our service areas that we have. I'll talk a little simple here. As you may know, there's three portions to providing electricity to a home. One is the generation, one is, Ms. Dahlin referred to, as a transmission, and one is a distribution. MMPA is our agency provider that provides us that generation and wholesale power. We're the people that distribute that energy once that comes off. This legislation here is a way we can provide power and somewhat eliminate some of the costs and some of the inefficiencies they have with the high transmission load and high voltage lines that we have. We've seen those costs go up quite a bit the past few years, and there's expectations that portion of our costs will continue to go up. By saving those costs, we can provide either flattening of our fees and our rates to our member communities, but also hopefully cut some of those costs and keep those rate increases over the years to a minimum. We also see a reliability issue that we don't have the line loss that we have using the transmission lines, and we see by locating that in our member communities that we have that reliable power source that Ms. Dahlin referred to. One thing I'd like to point out is we see a benefit to possible economic development. We think that industries, commercial, and kind of warehousing facilities that we have in Shakopee can see the benefit where we have that locally produced power right in our member community. We're the largest member community of MMPA. Our peak load is about 100 megawatts in the summertime, and we see a facility like this from anywhere from 10 to 25 megawatts being a significant portion that we'll have locally generated right in the community of Shakopee. So with that, we think this is great legislation. We hope you would support us. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to speak in favor of the bill? Is there anybody here who would like to speak in opposition to the bill? Is there anything else you'd like to say, Representative Lilly, about your bill?
Madam Chair and members, thank you for having us this morning. It's certainly been an asset for our community to be able to have municipal power and to offer that. I think some of the testimony has spoke about the ability to have it local and to, you know, the local crews are working on it, and the response times seem to be a little better than they might be in neighboring communities. And couple years back, it's not related to this, but you can kind of notice some of these communities because they have windmills that have gone up, and I don't know that they're fully getting a lot of power out of them yet, but it's, you know, at minimum, it's moving discussion on the future of energy, and so that's going on as well. So they're trying to do some good investments.
We have one member question. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Lilly or the testifiers, I think you mentioned this would be at load. What are we talking about as far as like MVA size and how much megawatts generation are we looking at in each of these sites?
Ms. Dolan?
Yes. Madam Chair, the facilities are approximately 10 facilities at about 10 megawatts on average, but their size to be at the same megawatt output as the substation that they would be located next to. So as Mr. Crooks mentioned earlier, there is a range, so we have a larger substation, for instance, in Shakopee, so they could range to as high as 25 megawatts. And so the voltage of those distribution lines are generally about 1247 kV.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. And so that's basically how you avoid the, I can't remember which exactly FERC order it was in 2001 that required competition between generation and load. And so by staying at the distribution levels, you avoid that FERC order. Okay. Other question is, if you had roughly, say, 100 megawatts of generation, how does this become part of the renewable energy standard requirements that we put in place? Because if you're adding additional non-qualifying facilities, what are you doing to actually, I mean, theoretically, you'd have to have 25 megawatts of additional renewables to go and offset 100, well, potentially 100 megawatts of non-qualifying facilities here. So what's the plan for that?
Ms. Dolan.
Madam Chair, the MMPA will absolutely be complying with the renewable portfolio standards. One of our newest generation assets that we've added here about a year and a half ago now, is the Oakland Wind Farm, which is a wind farm located outside of Blooming Prairie. So we're on track right now with the portfolio standards to meet the 2012 requirements, and we'll continue to increase our renewable generation in order to meet the increasing requirements as we get up to the 25% as you referenced in 2025.
Okay. Well, thank you. And Madam Chair, just maybe one editorial comment here is that I appreciate the fact that you're looking at distributed generation, and I like the arguments you make. I would say that a lot of the same arguments were made for locally distributed generation renewable projects, and we were often told that they were not commercially feasible or economically scalable or all these other things. And so I hope that this isn't just a one-sided argument that it, you know, works for the non-qualifying renewable facilities, but I think we had done quite a bit of work to try to site renewable facilities at load and didn't get much support from the utilities at the time.
Ms. Dolan, any response to that? We have one more member question.
I can just make, I guess, one comment, Madam Chair, on behalf of MMPA. Not, I can't speak, obviously, on behalf of other utilities, but we do have renewables that are located at load as well. They're not part of this proposed legislation here, but all of our smaller wind turbines are connected with the local loads, part of our hometown wind program. And we also have a facility that's in construction now that is located at load. That's a bioenergy facility. But your point is taken and is a good one.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This kind of follows up on what Representative Falk was talking about. I understand the motivations for doing this for the purpose of distributed power in terms of the reducing the transmission losses, improving the local reliability and so on. And I understand that your immediate plans are the natural gas small generators, but I don't understand why the legislation is written such that it's restricted to natural gas as a fuel and restricted to the reciprocating engines for the generators. Those seem to be features of your specific project, but they don't really speak to what the justifications for the exemption are. So I don't know. what are the thoughts on why that's included?
Ms. Dolan.
Madam Chair, we work to construct this legislation, as you said, for this program as it's contemplated here. But the, I guess, strictness of the type of technology, the design of the system that's being proposed here is not, wasn't necessarily critical to the legislation itself. It was just how our facilities were contemplated to be built.
Follow-up, Representative Russo, or? I just might offer, this is subdivision 98 in the personal property exemption section of the revenue code, so I suspect that these sort of details maybe are listed in each of the previous 97 exemptions, and so maybe that's why they followed that pattern, but I...
I don't know enough about the background being new here to offer to fix that or anything like that.
We have one more member question from Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the questioning around the table about the personal property tax exemption, I've carried a couple of these in the decade I've been here, and they've been for either investor-owned utilities. Well, I think every one of them has been an investor-owned utility, where we routinely grant the personal property tax exemption and let the utility work out a payment in lieu of with the local hosting facility in my own backyard, the Blue Lake Peaking Plant, which I think is up over 400 megawatts now. Got an exemption. They worked a thing out with Shakopee to do that, and they are pretty routine. In this case, I would point out that the four facilities that Representative Lilly just mentioned are actually owned by the municipalities that would be levying the tax. So I think you can see it's kind of silly to levy a tax on stuff that's going to go into your coffers anyhow. So you charge your ratepayers, and then I don't know what Mr. Crooks, I think every once in a while the city council asks you for a donation to the park fund or something like that. But technically, these will be owned by the agency that you're all members of. But personal property tax exemption in this case, where the municipals are actually owning it, certainly meets the common sense threshold. And I have one question after that, but just a comment. And I want just to make sure I'm on track. If they wish to respond to it, that would be fine. But seeing none, I have a question then, Madam Chair. You mentioned, Ms. Dolan, that these would be reciprocating engines. These are not turbines. These will be natural gas-fired reciprocating engines, much like we have at the Flying Cloud landfill. Is that what I'm understanding then?
Ms. Dolan.
Correct, Madam Chair. The facilities, because they're somewhat smaller, mm-hmm. are better sized for reciprocating engines rather than generally a turbine is a little bit larger.
And, Madam Chair, just to conclude my comments then, we've had this discussion about distributed generation over the past several years, and the efficiencies of scaling a larger facility when you're trying to build a 1,000-megawatt facility or something, there is an economy of scale that the ratepayers actually benefit from. In this case, though, because it's reciprocating, the cost per watt is probably very comparable, and we don't have transmission costs. So this still meets the economic sensibility test, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It's not like all of a sudden we're switching gears on distributed generation. These will act more like peakers or fillers or backup facilities, much like we have at a college campus or at a hospital now. And we can do it as economically as adding capacity to a big central plant somewhere. So I just wanted to make that observation that it actually isn't switching directions. It's actually staying true to our principle of the lowest cost, most efficient way to spend the money. Thank you.
At this point, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 337, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Tax Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative
Lee. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And we're going to move on to learn about the Renewable Development Fund. We'll let Mr. Eliff do his presentation, and then the representatives from Xcel Energy, and then we'll do member questions when the presentations have concluded. So, Mr. Eliff, you're first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some handouts, if the page could come and grab those at some point. That would be helpful. Members, you may remember that the Renewable Development Fund is one of those entities that emerged from the compromise back in 1994 when Xcel was seeking a certificate of need to build storage for nuclear waste from its Prairie Island facility. One of the entities to come out of that was the Renewable Energy Standard, which we still have, and also there were wind and biomass mandates for Xcel that were a result of that compromise. And the RDF was another one. At the time it was devised, it was the only state funding source that was exclusively dedicated to renewable energy. And here we are almost 20 years later, and that is still the case. One of the things I found when looking back at the legislative history that was a little bit surprising is, frankly, how little of it there is. In 1994, when the original bill was passed, the legislation with respect to the RDF said two things. One, beginning in 1999, Xcel must transfer $500,000 per cask per year into the fund. The second thing was, and I'll quote the entire sentence here, funds in the account may be expended only for the development of renewable energy sources within the state. So those two points were the only direction given for the Renewable Development Fund back in 1994. In 1999, when Xcel started making contributions to the fund, the legislature added a few more points. One thing it did, of course, was say that expenditures are recoverable from ratepayers for Xcel, and those are included in the resource adjustment fee, which you might see on your Xcel bill. In addition, the legislature said that preference must be given to the development of renewable resources located within the state, and that expenditures from the fund could only be made after Public Utilities Commission approval upon petition by Xcel. And in 2002, I believe, or 2003, the first expenditures were approved by the PUC from the RDF. Also in that year, the legislature changed the funding mechanism. Rather than $500,000 a cask, it went to a flat rate of $16 million a year that Xcel would pay into the fund, and when the plant was not operating, $7.5 million a year if the company was not making a good faith effort to have that waste removed. Jump ahead four years to 2007, and Monticello was added to the mix. The legislature said Monticello, or $350,000 casks for at Monticello, which are smaller than the ones at Xcel. And when Monticello is not operating, $5.25 million a year had to be contributed to the fund. In 2007, the legislature also said that Xcel was eligible for grants from the fund, but that the board must evaluate the utility proposals in the same manner as it evaluated other proposals. And finally, in 2010, the legislature went back to its original funding mechanism of $500,000 a cask at Prairie Island, and that's what remains at this point. So that's really not much legislative history, and it really doesn't specify what the fund or how the fund is supposed to work, who's supposed to be on the board that looks at it. And in the absence of that legislative direction, the Public Utilities Commission issued a number of orders beginning in 2000 and continuing that established a project selection process and a governance model. And frankly, other things have just evolved as this entity developed. One of which, at least as far as I can tell, and maybe some folks from Xcel who will be here later can speak to this, is the RDF board itself. I talked to somebody at the Public Utilities Commission, and they told me that the board was not created by the PUC. It certainly was not created by the legislature. But lo and behold, we have a board that is now made up of two representatives from Xcel, two representatives from the environmental community, one representative from the Prairie Island Indian community, and added later was two representatives for Xcel ratepayers, one from the residential class and one from the commercial class. That board reviews grant proposals and also makes recommendations of what proposals should be funded to Xcel, which in turn recommends project to the Public Utilities Commission. There are currently no procedures for nominating members to that board or selecting, appointing new board members or anything about the length of term that those members have. So that is just information that we don't have at this point, but the board seems to have been operating pretty well for the last 20 years. Initially, all the RDF expenditures went through this PUC approval process. The first cycle of grants was awarded in 2002 for about $15 million. The next cycle in 2004 for over $20 million. But beginning in 2003, the legislature started mandating the use of renewable development funds for some specific programs and projects. And this, the appropriations were meant that, that this money was often to be managed by other entities, such as the Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment at the University of Minnesota, and also for the Department of Commerce. One of the things it did in 2003 was appropriate money from the fund to what we call the REPRI program, Renewable Energy Production Incentive, which I spoke about last time we had an overview. This is a fund that pays 1.5 cents a kilowatt hour produced to up to 200 megawatts of wind power that was developed in the early 2000s. In 2003, the legislature authorized up to $6 million a year for that purpose. $4.5 million was supposed to go for 100 megawatts of wind, the remaining $1.5 million for Ulm Farm Biogas. In 2005, that amount was increased to $10.9 million a year for REPI, and that's where it stayed since that point. Also in 2003, the legislature directed that $10 million from the RDF go to the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment at the University of Minnesota for grants dealing with renewable energies. An additional $3 million was awarded to IRE, as we call it, in 2007. And in 2009, the legislature directed that $5 million a year be awarded to IRE each year from 2009 to 2012. So over that 12-year period, about $33 million went from the RDF fund to the university. In 2010, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, at the request of the Legislative Audit Commission, did an audit of the Renewable Development Fund, and a lot of the information I'll be talking about hereafter was taken from that report. One of the things the OLA noted was that some of the directions given by the legislature for funding and some that was done at the University of Minnesota was for non-electric uses and also for non-energy uses. Although you may remember that that initial direction from the legislature back in 1994 didn't specify that it was electricity, renewable electricity sources that were to be supported by the fund, even though it's electricity customers who are supporting the fund. In 2007 to 2009, the legislature mandated more than 24 different initiatives that were funded by the RDF for a total of $14 million, over $14 million, including solar rebates, cost sharing for the E85 program, establishing pumps that pumped ethanol in the state. We gave money to do research into innovative auto technologies, to do a green manufacturing and jobs report, to look at reuses of the Ford plant in St. Paul, to do some studies regarding cap and trade systems. And in 2010, legislature authorized $21 million over a five-year period for solar rebates for solar modules manufactured in Minnesota. The OLA estimated that about one-third of those expenditures were not for electricity during those years. If you could turn to the handout that I provided right now, these are tables and figures taken directly from the OLA report to give you some idea of essentially where the money has been spent during this year. And the first one just shows total spending from the RDF fund from 2003 to 2010. As I mentioned, the first cycle of grants the RFP was sent out in 2002, so the 2003 spending reflects that. Second cycle, I think, was in 2004. The third cycle was in 2007. The fund does not send out cycles every year, depending on the amount of money that's in the fund. They want to wait until there's enough in the fund to warrant sending out a request for proposal and there have been none since 2007, although I think, as we'll hear from Excel, the fourth cycle is just about ready to be launched out the door. So in 2009 and 2010, when annual spending from the fund is around $25 million, that's representing all of the renewable energy production incentives at about a little less than $10 million a year, and the rest is legislative appropriations, as I mentioned earlier. In 2011, after the OLA report came out, the legislature suspended spending from the fund while it studied that report, and I'll talk a little bit about the legislation that occurred in 2012, which made some changes in the program. The next figure, which is labeled figure 1.3 from the OLA report, shows how much of the fund is administered by Xcel Energy versus how much has been administered directly by the legislature. And as you can see, those two lighter colored parts of the circle represent legislative directives. 56% of the funds spent from 2002 to 2010 were directed by the legislature. And the next table on the next page shows how many of those grants were awarded, the average amount of those grants, and which of the three entities essentially awarded and managed those grants. So you've got some grants going through the Public Utilities Commission through the process that I described earlier, some grants going directly to the University of Minnesota, which awards them to various research projects, and the Department of Commerce handled most of the legislatively mandated grants that went to other entities. And you can see that the median grant amount in the rightmost column is very different for all those. The PUC and Excel grants over $900,000 a year. I think part of the reason for that is that those are often multi-year projects, and they are more research-based projects. University of Minnesota grants are much smaller. Department of Commerce grants averaging $150,000. The next chart is one that I put together from information in the report just to show, of the PUC-approved grant projects, how many are for research and development versus what the commission calls energy production, which are designed to actually demonstrate and produce renewable energies. And as you can see, over three-quarters of the grants are for research and development, and they account for more than half the funds, 55% of the funds, while energy production projects represent 14% of the grants and consume 40% of the grant funds. Finally, the last page in the handout indicates what types of renewable energy sources have been supported by the fund since its inception till 2010. And as you can see in the first line there, 46% of the grants have gone to biomass, which I think is pretty interesting. 17% to solar, 10% to wind, 21% to other. That's covering a lot of the of legislatively mandated grants for studies and other things. The board, according to the OLA, does not really second guess the legislative projects that are mandated by the legislature. Those are included in an annual expenditure forecast, which is then forwarded to Excel, and Excel sends that to the PUC for approval each year. So in a sense, the PUC is approving also the legislatively mandated grants. And one of the results of this, which I think the OLA points out, is that project selection and oversight is kind of fragmented among these three groups: the Commission, the University of Minnesota, and the Department of Commerce. For example, the PUC basically has declared non-electricity projects as not being eligible, and they don't fund them, whereas the legislature and the University of Minnesota have done that. Other differences or fragmentation occurs in how these grants are administered. The University of Minnesota does not sign formal contracts with its grantees, and funding for those grants is upfront rather than reimbursed when certain milestones are achieved, which is the way that the state handles those grants. Administrative costs are also handled differently among these three entities. Generally, the Department of Commerce doesn't charge them. It simply uses its general funds to deal with administrative costs. Excel does pay consultants to review proposals. One of the other features of the proposal approval process that, again, just sort of appeared is the use of a third-party reviewer to evaluate all those proposals and make recommendations. And that Xcel pays consultants as part of its administrative costs, but it, according to the OLA, doesn't pay overhead costs. In contrast, the University of Minnesota does pay overhead costs, and even sometimes, according to the report, extends those to non-RDF projects. I want to talk a little bit about the 2012 legislation, which made some changes in the project. And to a large degree, what it did was put into statute what has previously been incorporated into the program, either directly by PUC order or the practices that I've described that have simply evolved through the process. And it also incorporated some material that responds directly to the OLA report and the concerns that they raised. One of the, I think, most important things it does is expand the spending language. You might recall, again, that that 1994 law just said funds may be expended for the development of renewable energy sources. In 2012, this was expanded to allow for spending money from the fund for the following purposes: to increase the market penetration within the state of renewable electric energy resources at reasonable costs, to promote the startup, expansion, and attraction of renewable electric energy projects and companies within the state, to stimulate research and development within the state into renewable electric energy technologies. Those three, which you'll notice all include the word electric, were taken directly from a PUC order. And it added, the legislature added a fourth clause in here: to develop near commercial and demonstration scale renewable electric projects or near commercial and demonstration scale electric infrastructure delivery projects if those delivery projects enhance the delivery of renewable electric energy. So we have a much better sense of what this money is supposed to be spent on, I think, than we did before. A second thing that was added during that 2012 legislation is that the authority of the PUC was expanded somewhat. It could always approve expenditures. Now it can disapprove expenditures, and also can modify expenditures if those modifications are agreed to by Xcel. A third change was, actually putting something in the law that had kind of come out of a PUC order, was that the PUC can approve reasonable and necessary expenditures for administering the account, limited to up to 5% of expenditures. The 2012 law also clarified that the account is to be managed by Xcel, but it must consult with what the law calls an advisory group, which we know as the RDF board, with respect to developing the RFP and also to evaluating the projects. Again, that's something that happened through PUC order. As I mentioned, proposals must be evaluated by a third-party expert. That was incorporated into the statute. One thing that was new is that the RFP can include or be limited to higher educational institutions that are located here in Minnesota for multiple R&D projects. And it sets up a merit peer review system that substitutes for that third-party review that other projects are required to go through. The legislation also notes that Xcel should try to reach agreement with the board, but Xcel has full and sole authority to recommend expenditures to the commission. One of the other points that was made, I think, in the OLA report was that there was a pretty not a strong tie necessarily between the benefits from this program and the fact that those benefits should come back to Minnesota ratepayers and to Minnesota as a state. And one of the things the 2012 legislation did is say, in developing the RFP and also in evaluating proposals, Xcel, quote, must strongly consider, where reasonable, potential benefit to Minnesota citizens and businesses and the utilities ratepayers, unquote. One other thing that was included in the legislation was with respect to the final written report on these projects. The OLA found that in some cases there was not enough detail in those reports. In other cases, it was found that it was impossible for non-technical people to read. It also advocated posting these reports on the web and acknowledging that the project received RDF funds. All of those points were included in the 2012 legislation. And finally, there is also placed in the legislation a provision saying that funds from the RDF cannot be directly appropriated by the legislature. We need PUC order. And I hear Representative Beard chuckling even now because he knows that no legislature is bound by what the previous legislature says. And I will admit to already authoring draft bills that step in and put our hand in the RDF fund. So, Madam Chair, that's my summary.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. And now we're going to hear from Excel on the they prepare a report every year, I believe it's every year, that's due on February 15th. And I'm a big fan of when we require a report that we actually read the report. And I'm also a big fan of when the legislative auditor finds problems that we fix those problems. So thank you for being willing to do the presentation and 3 days, just 3 days after the report's due date. So go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy Government Affairs. I'll let Paul Lehman introduce himself when he gets to the bulk of the presentation. I'm just going to cover a couple of things which, frankly, Mr. Eliff already covered pretty thoroughly, so I will try to be very quick. Mr. Eliff referred to the legislative audit auditor's recommendations after they completed their 2010 audit of the fund. One of the reasons that this fund has created some confusion and lack of clarity is because it really is a unique fund in the in Minnesota law. And the legislative auditor pointed that out. I note in the third bullet point there, it was never really very clear exactly whether this was a state fund or a private fund. In point of fact, the money never leaves XL Energy until it's given to grantees. The state never takes possession of the money in any respect. And so the directives that Mr. Eliff referred to, you know, oftentimes appear more like spending requirements than actual appropriations out of the fund. That is a law that directs XL Energy or the PUC to spend RDF money in a certain way, not unlike, for example, the conservation improvement programs where a certain amount of spending is directed by the legislature as a matter of law. But the Legislative Audit Commission did raise the issue of whether or not this money should be treated like state money or private money, and that was one of the things that was addressed in the legislation last year. The other points that I have on this slide, I think Mr. Eliff covered very well. The just to add a little bit of color to the history that Mr. Eliff provided, I am told, though I wasn't with the company in 1994, that the RDF was established in the 1994 Prairie Island Law, and then a few years later when the first cask was placed out on the pad was the first time that XL had an obligation then to deposit money or to provide money in the Renewable Development Fund. And I'm told that when that occurred and we had a $500,000 obligation, the question came up is, well, what are we supposed to do? Because the legislation that established the fund didn't really give much direction. And so, as Mr. Eliff recounted, the evolution of an advisory board, the XL process, and the PUC process started to occur at that point as both XL and the environmental community, as well as a bunch of other stakeholders, including the PUC, started putting together the series of orders, which now really make up the handbook for how the RDF has functioned. One of the things that was accomplished in the 2012 legislation, and Mr. Eliff covered, you know, I think very thoroughly all of those, but there was, for lack of a better word, sort of a rededication to the idea that this is a private fund administered by XL Energy with the consent of the Public Utilities Commission to accomplish certain goals, which were, I think, made more specific and clear in the 2012 legislation. But just so you know, there is not actually a bank account, there is not a fund transferred to the state, or even a fund maintained at XL Energy. Rather, we keep track annually of how much money is to be obligated in this way because of the number of casks that we have at the two plants, and then the expenditures that are made in the grant-making process are credited against that account, and so that's how we keep track of it. There's not, technically speaking, really a fund or an account. There's an account only in the sense that XL Energy keeps track of this on their books. The other thing I do want to mention is the higher education fund, because that's a new and that's a new feature of the fund. As Mr. Eloff noted, in the past there was money that was spending that was required out of the fund to the University of Minnesota. In the legislation last year, actually the last $5 million increment of that money to the U of M was canceled by the legislation. And in the discussions with the U of M and other stakeholders, it was determined that we would establish a separate higher education program within the Renewable Development Fund, where institutions of higher education, including the University of Minnesota, but also any other higher education institution, could apply for money that they would then re-grant through in a more stringent academic process, which is different than the process that we've used for our grant making. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Lehman, who administers the fund for Xcel Energy now, operates the fund for us, and let him describe where we've gone from here.
Thank you for being here. Go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, members of the Energy Policy Committee. My name is Paul J. Lehman, and my responsibility is a regulatory manager for the company to manage this program, amongst other activities that fall under my responsibility. While I've been with the company for 35 years, this particular program has only been under my responsibility for about just under a year. So I rely upon Mr. Evans for a lot of the historic, and I have a administrator of the RDF program who knows the more nuts and bolts. So if you do have anything that's really detailed or historic, I might rely on either one of those gentlemen. And my understanding is there's at least one member of the RDF advisory group in the audience as well. So we've got plenty of background and brain power for this group. As you know, as was discussed, we've submitted a couple reports just recently. They were actually filed on Friday, one to this legislature and one to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. And some of the numbers or information that you saw in the previous discussion will be different than I have in those documents or in this presentation, simply because of vintage. That presentation or those materials that you saw earlier had an estimate for 2010 and did not include 2011 or 2012. The information I now have goes through the end of calendar year 2012. As also was discussed, we follow certain principles for the Renewable Development Fund, and as part of the process of administering or overseeing that, we make sure that we are accountable for how those customers, those ratepayer dollars, are used. And so we do quite a bit of accountability for the projects and make sure that we get the milestones and policy objectives in line with where they should be. We do have independent evaluators that we make use of to help with the grant process, and there is transparency in that we report everything to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. That is reviewed by the Department of Commerce, and we get the information well vetted through them. The process that we're in right now, we've just initiated our fourth cycle of our issuing or awarding grants under the Renewable Development Fund. And so we have consulted with the advisory group, as was pointed out, as they're now titled, as opposed to an advisory board. The legislature did modify the terminology of that group. And we've developed the selection criteria, as well as what's referred to as a standard contract. In other words, if the grantee, or excuse me, the bidders, match all the terms and conditions of that contract, we have a contract ready to sign with them that's been approved by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. If there are other contracts that terms and conditions that need to be brought forward, we will bring those to the commission as well. Again, we're in the process of hiring the independent third evaluator who will help us evaluate those proposals. And then we will seek input from the advisory group to select the projects and submit those to the commission. And then we will, on an ongoing basis, going forward basis, administer those grant contracts and issue the funds as milestones. So here's a little bit of a summary of some of the numbers. Again, they're going to be a little bit different than what you just saw. Between the two broad categories of energy production projects and research and development projects, we have 62 That's up from the 59 that was shown in the previous materials. For those projects that are fall under the energy production, we believe we've done a good job of helping the Renewable Development Fund awards to be leveraged against other funds that are brought to the projects. So we're seeing roughly about a $1 of Renewable Development Fund investment being leveraged against about $2.50 of other funding towards projects that are falling under this category. In research and development, there's not as many other lucrative dollars for the R&D projects to make use of, so we see about a 40 cents additional funding to every dollar we invest in those renewable research and development funds. Jobs are as are shown here is what we've estimated the job impact from each of these programs. Some more statistics as to what we've got under each of these categories, about just short of 22 megawatts of energy production projects and research and development projects that have gone through a variety of scientific articles and presentations and patents. We also have tried to look at the benefits from this program, and so we've worked with a variety of sources to try to put a quantification on that as best we can. Obviously, some of those quantifications are subject to certain assumptions or certain ways of looking at it, but these roughly show what we think are coming from environmental benefits, the avoided need to build other generating capacity in our system, the avoidance of producing the energy that the projects that we have funded through this project, and then an estimate of how much additional stimulus we've seen come about in the Minnesota economy. Again, another breakdown. We're seeing a lot of different slices to the pie of the Renewable Development Fund, that the dollars that we're collecting on a going forward basis from our customers. We've gone into a variety of buckets as to how they've been utilized. Again, as was discussed before, they do fall from somewhat of a legislatively mandated arena, as well as programs that have successfully bid into the various funding cycles that we've had. Right now, we're showing our amount of funds that are available to the fourth cycle, and we see actually there's going to be a little bit more than that when you count dollars going forward. So we're seeing approximately $30 million that we have available, or we expect to be available for this most current funding cycle that we're going to be going through. And that's the information we had, and we're open for questions.
Representative Hornstein.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions, I guess, it would be related to Mr. Eliff's presentation. So thank you, by the way. That was great. I just wanted a little bit more detail on the – this is page 5, your table 2.3. When you mentioned other 21%, that's a very large percentage, and so you mentioned this is legislatively directed. What would be some examples of that, that 21% – 43 projects.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein. Yes, that's where I mentioned some of these grants. I mean, just examples of these grants were for that E85 cost share program. $1 million was used, for solar rebates, but that went into solar rights. So there was a study done of innovative auto technologies that would be included in others, since it doesn't apply necessarily to any of the renewables. The study for reuses of the Ford plant would be one that was in that category. The Green Manufacturing and Jobs Report, and also the cap and trade studies.
Okay.
Representative Hornstein.
And then, Madam Chair, this could either be for Mr. Eliff or the testifiers. I vaguely remember this a few years ago, but it'd be good to get a little bit more detail on this now that I'm on the committee. How was it that Excelsior Energy got $10 million? I mean, that we supported a coal project through the Renewable Development Fund. How did that happen?
Mr. Eliff, would you like to comment?
The legislature voted for it, is the answer. That was in
2005.
Yeah, I think 2005, and it was legislation said that it should be awarded $2 million for 5 years to that project, and there was some controversy at the time. I remember the PUC had to come out with an order whether legislature absolutely meant that they got the grant or didn't, and the commission determined that the PUC or that the legislature had meant to award that money. My recollection, and Excel can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the board rejected that project, but that the commission awarded the money. And after that, I believe the plant, which, as you know, is not built yet, but they brought a power purchase agreement to the PUC for approval in 2007, which the commission rejected as not being in the public interest because the prices were, in its estimate, unreasonably high. And that decision was appealed to the Court of Appeals, which concurred with the PUC. That happened in 2010.
Representative Hornstein.
Madam Chair, I hope that this is the only time this will happen. I just don't think under any definition coal would be renewable. So, at least in law or otherwise.
Yeah.
What's that?
It takes 1,000 years for it to renew.
Yeah, yeah, right. So, I don't know whether it needs more conversation, but I just hope that will ever happen again. And I don't know if we need a law to prohibit coal from being used in this way, but for coal projects to be used in this account. But I just wanted that noted, and hopefully it won't happen again.
Representative Beard.
He's looking at
me. Thanks, Madam Chair. We actually have a law that prohibits us from using coal ever again in the state. We tried to overturn it here a couple years ago, and we're not successful.
Can I just point out that it doesn't forbid that we ever use coal. We just need to offset its emissions.
As you wish, Madam Chair. We could debate that till the cows come home. The whole thing, yeah, it kind of had to be there. There were two mandates in the original bill that were handed to me to author. As a companion bill to the renewal of the extension of the cast storage at both Monticello and Prairie Island. And in a bipartisan fashion, actually, the whole thing came together because at the time, load base was growing, our demand for power was growing, and we were outstripping our generation supply. You remember this was 2003 and 2004, before the Great Recession hit, and electrical usage peaked and has actually been in somewhat of a decline since. But there were two parts in the original bill. There was a mandate that Xcel Energy had to buy the power from the clean coal technology plant that Excelsior was promoting, and there was a mandate that they get an award from the Renewable Development Fund. This legislator clearly recalls telling the author of the bill, or the drafter of the bill, no, there would be no mandates. We can write it that they get to go to the head of the line and negotiate first, and indeed that's what happened on the power purchase agreement, and we made clear to everyone who asked that there was no mandate that Xcel had to buy their power, but they can indeed were free to negotiate. And as it turned out, when it wasn't good for the ratepayers, the court and the PUC agreed. I seem to recall, too, that the award from the Renewable Development Fund was an argument over that it was an innovative energy project, that it was not renewable, but it was an innovative energy project, and that was the definition we put into law that allowed it to apply for. They were entitled to apply to the RDF fund for the funds, which was the custom in that day that the legislature monkeyed with the definitions and who spent what out of Xcel's bank account. Thank you for being so magnanimous about that, by the way, Xcel. And so it was awarded, but the legislature did not interfere and say you must. That was my recollection of the whole thing. But the peg we hung the hat on was the Innovative Energy Project, because in those days there was also a push to rebuild and expand the Big Stone Power Plant, which would have been all coal, and one of the alternatives we were looking at was a better way to use coal in our generation mix and convert it to gas or to natural gas, CH4 methane, and extract all the impurities that were going up the smokestack. It struck some of us as a prudent and reasonable thing to do, and so that's why we did it. We can always look back at it now and throw rocks at it, and the process, I think, needed to be examined, which is why Senator Rose and I carried the RDF bill last year to revise how we handled the money and to actually codify in law things that the legislative auditor pointed out. For instance, we were telling a private company how they would spend their money and how they'd run their accounting, among other things. So there's just a little more of the background about how that worked. Yes, I did it. Yes, I tried to blunt it by removing the mandates. And yes, it happened anyhow. And there you have it.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Representative Garofalo.
I always feel so dumb after Representative Beard talks. Just for staff, the REPI portion of the RDF, if you could just provide a little legislative history and tell us about where we're at on that right now. Yeah, that was it.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
I know. It's
me, Mr. Eliff. I have this responsibility to toss the ball. I forget that. Go ahead.
Can you do that now?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
I thought you said could you write up something first on that?
No, I'm sorry. If you could maybe communicate in a way that I would understand.
Okay.
Go ahead, please. Thank you.
Well, this happened a little bit before I came to the legislature as well. But my understanding was that in 2003, it was determined, it was determined that the state should help some small wind producers get up and running. And one of the ways of doing that was providing them with a revenue stream that they could then take to a bank to help them enable financing to pay for the project's upfront costs. And what was put into legislation was, I guess this was done in two separate pieces, actually, 100 megawatts each. The initial 100 megawatts, which was funded with this 1.5 cent per kilowatt hour subsidy, came from the general fund for a few years. About $13.8 million was spent from the general fund. But when the second 100 megawatts was, mandated, after that, the RDF covered both pieces, so 200 megawatts total. And my recollection was that that 200 megawatts was filled up in a very short amount of time with projects at that capacity. And projects that were that qualified for it were paid that 1.5 cents for 10 years, for a 10-year period. And we are now starting to see those early projects drop off. They've finished their 10-year period. My understanding is, I think Excel pointed out that we've spent $70 million through 2012 on REPI. So, this year we'll spend a little bit under $10 million, and I believe the forecasts I've seen from the Department of Commerce is that we've got about another $27, $28 million to go for those projects that came in a little later and won't be winding down until, I believe, 2018, if I'm not incorrect.
Representative Graffel, and I don't know if Excel wanted to add anything to the content on the REPI payments for wind.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Eliff explained it pretty well. We're starting to see those payments tail off as the 10-year contracts expire. Those windmills will presumably continue to generate energy, but they won't be receiving the subsidy, per kilowatt hour that they had been receiving, which was intended to get them started up. And so the drain on the fund due to those REPI payments will then start to decrease. And I think you're right, about 2018, they kind of go away. And so all of the resources, if the fund still exists then, all of the resources of the fund will be available for the grant process or other purposes.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, and to either Mr. Evans or to staff, I think you alluded this in your comments, is that previously this was funded by both the RDF and the general fund. Is that correct?
Mr. Eliff.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, my understanding is that for the first few years, for this first 100 megawatt chunk was funded through the general fund and a total of about $13.8 million, but then it was transferred to come out of the RDF.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, and I'm reluctant to ask questions I don't know the answers to in committee, but I'll do it anyways. My guess is that part of this changeover from the general fund to the RDF was some level of budget pressures. I don't need an answer, but can I see a nod, a shake, yes or no? Is that fair enough?
Mr. Eliff.
I don't know for sure. Okay. I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know for sure.
Okay. Mr. Evans. Do you want to provide any comment?
Madam Chair, I think that's there were probably a number of reasons, you know, in the minds of each legislator who voted for it, but I know that there was concern that here was an available source of money, and the state, of course, was having its budget problems.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, just from I'll offer my opinion on it, is that it seems a lot of what the RDF is doing, and respectfully disagree with the person who has a lot more knowledge in this subject matter than me, but it seems like there's appropriation authority going on here. And I understand it's Xcel Energy's money through the ratepayers that's being offered out there, but I mean this resembles almost tax expenditures where there's money being spent out there that this legislature should be prescribing, or at the very least should be telling people how to spend, as opposed to what we've done in the past. And I know I disagree with my friend on that, but this seems to model appropriation authority quite a bit, and that seems to be the legislature's prerogative. And I guess I'd be interested in studying and learning more about the trade-offs about why the legislature should not be appropriating this money. Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the testimony and information. I was analyzing this, looking at the different projects, where they're at. Notice that there are five regions defined in the state, and all but one of those regions have wind and solar projects, so I was a little bit curious about trying to distribute that around, because if we're going to have renewable energy, you know, hopefully we'd have it around the state, and that there might be some differences in the regions, you know, grid, you know, etc. It'd be good to have at least some of that going on in all the regions. And then I'd also notice that outside the state of Minnesota is a total that's higher than three of the regions. And analyzing that further, I'm noticing a good portion of that is in solar. And I guess I don't understand why, you know, this is solar research. Most of the in-state, other than one I saw, was installation of solar, you know, panels in different facilities, which it's good to understand how you integrate that technology into applications and the grid and, you know, our environment. But when you're doing direct write or inkjet, quote-unquote, printing on, I know that there are several companies in the state of Minnesota that are working on, you know, printing electronic circuits with this kind of technology. And I would think it'd be nice to, as we've hinted in solar, foster that research, production, skill, and development within the state, instead of, you know, spending millions of dollars outside, you know, the state of Minnesota for that. So if there's a, enlightenment of the process and, you know, how you look at by region, or if it's just by grant proposal, why don't you have a eye to the fact that different parts of the state may have some different and unique circumstances when you're installing the wind or installing the solar? And then, since the University of Minnesota has a great deal of portion, 12% of the funding, and maybe a little bit higher than that in the number of projects, why aren't they fostering this innovativeness within the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Evans or Mr. Lehman?
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Lehman.
I'll try to answer some of the questions there. There were a few of them. First, with the respect to balancing the regions, why there isn't a more balanced distribution of the projects throughout the state. A couple reasons. One, obviously, is it depends on what comes to our door, what bids into the program, what seeks funding from us. We're not actively attempting to develop a project in a particular location, but we provide that for informational benefit of those who are observing our program and to see where those are. A second reason is that certain things, certain renewable projects are best suited for certain parts of the state. As we well know, that wind is west and solar is more dispersed, but it still has to be, work within the confines of the electric utility transmission and distribution system that exists in the state as it stands right now. Third, as we've talked, the funding for this comes from the customers, the ratepayers of Xcel Energy. And so we look to seek funds that give most benefit to our own customers, and generally those are projects that are within our service territory. So those are some of the reasons why the balancing of the projects throughout the state isn't uniformly balanced, and why there might be even a location that's limited or non-existent. Second, the area question related to out-of-state activities. And again, preference would be for projects in the state of Minnesota, but specifically projects that benefit the state of Minnesota. When it comes to some of the projects, that benefit might come about from not being, from being developed or proposed outside of the state, simply because that's how the technology or the industry benefits as a whole throughout the country, and therefore hopefully the state of Minnesota would benefit as well. So to a certain degree, that's taken into consideration, or has been taken into consideration. I think it's fair to say there's probably a lot more emphasis at the current time on making sure that as many of the funds that we're going to be granting have the direct and measurable benefits to our customers within the state of Minnesota, and that may very well give those projects that actually develop in the state of Minnesota a higher consideration. The last one, I'm not sure I can speak to the University of Minnesota funds that have been given to them and how they might have spent.
Representative Quam, any follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, since you had translated from University of Minnesota just specific to higher education, I thought that you might be able to let us know how that evolution would also include, a philosophy. But, again, the sun shines across the state, and, all but one region having solar installations or solar projects, and then the same with the wind. I've noticed wind facilities actually almost across the state, especially with the non-standard cyclone, style that they're trying out in the Twin Cities. So I just was hoping there might be a more open understanding with that progression. This board is not, appointed by the legislature or the government, and so I would assume that your company would be, well informed in that. And I think it's perfectly fine, that you do that. It's like we define the end results, and you just, go to meet those end results, just like conserving and what you do with your customers to help them be more efficient. We don't tell you exactly how to do that, just that we want the, 1.5%, et cetera. But, hopefully this research and the push for the solar and doing stuff inside the state, in the future, that might be a little higher on, when you're looking through the projects. So, in the future, that might be a little higher on, when you're looking through the projects. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, just to refer to that last point, that was one of the concerns raised by the legislative auditor, was the degree to which funds had left the state, and that was one, I think Mr. Eloff pointed out, it was one of the changes that was made in 2012, was, not that it has to exclusively be within the state of Minnesota, but that greater attention be paid to projects that serve the customers who are actually paying the money in. So I think, as Mr. Lehman pointed out, that will be a firmer direction in that direction than we've seen historically in the fund.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, how
On a year-by-year basis, how do the requests for allocations of grants that you receive compare to the resources you have available to fund those grants? Are you getting far more grant applications than you could ever possibly fund as these REPI dollars fall off over the course of the next 5 or 6 years? Do you anticipate being able to fund more of those grants? How's the supply and demand working out there?
Mr. Lehman.
Thank you. I think the basic answer is yes. We've seen more bids, more proposals brought forward than funds available, and I would fully expect that same thing to happen in this cycle. Part of it is because there are proposals that may not meet all of the criteria that we've laid out in our proposal, and so those will be screened out sort of immediately as that those don't fit the bill. But then we sometimes have some very good projects that will compete against each other, and we try to seek the best project out of the group of projects that are competing against each other. As more funds become available for the next round, the fifth cycle or the sixth cycle, that would, I expect, allow us to fund more individual projects. It all comes down to what it is that they're proposing. Do they need more money for projects where all of the low-hanging fruit has been taken already to this point, or and the harder projects need to come forward and maybe looking to seek more money from us? So I think the general answer is yes, that we've had more interest than we've been able to fully fund. But I think what we've funded have been very good projects at this point.
Representative Morgan, follow up. I had a question about the five patents that arose in part out of the grants made from the RDF. Does the RDF retain any ownership interest or any income share interest in the patents that have been produced? Mr. Lehman.
Thank you. I believe I have that, but I'm just going to double check to make sure I don't miss anything. In the past approach that we had, we retained and we expect to or will continue to retain a right to use the technology that's funded by the RDF program. We had had a approach where if there was a patentable technology, we had the right to what's referred to as a march-in right, that we could step in and actually patent it ourselves if the recipient chose not to patent it. We have yet to exercise that simply because we're not in the business of patenting renewable development technologies, so that's not something we would prefer to do. In this current funding cycle, what we've asked is for bidders to propose what sharing of any royalties that they might obtain as a result of their patents with us. They could propose zero, or they could propose some number greater than zero, and that would be one thing that we take into consideration as we evaluate those proposals, is if they're sharing a certain amount of the benefit that comes from the granting of the funds to the technology development.
Just a follow-up to that, then, would the if a patent did begin to produce revenue, would the money that Excel had the interest in be deposited in the RDF fund, or the accounting mechanism known as the RDF fund, or would it be in the general coffers of Excel? Mr. Lehman.
We rarely get to put things into the general coffers of Excel Energy. No, the approach that we would intend to use is that it would become a line item in our request to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to determine how much we need to charge our customers, so it would be an offsetting, that revenue stream would be an offsetting funding towards what we need to charge customers for the rest of the project. So it would be used for the benefit of the Renewable Development Fund.
Thank you. I think that's it for questions. I have unless there's anybody I missed, I have a couple announcements as to scheduling, and thank you for your presentations to everyone. I'm sure they're available after committee if people think of questions. I think the reports that were provided were really excellent, and so I hope people will spend time really going through the information. Our next hearing is tomorrow. Because the Senate committee meets on a different schedule than ours, the committee will start at 12 noon in 123 Capitol, so that's a half an hour earlier. Is there a big feedback on this, or am I just hearing it? Okay. So if members can be in their seats in the Capitol by noon, that would be great. And I understand our committees then meet back here at 2:15. The Senate committee goes until 2:30. So if when we get up and leave the Senate committee, we can be quiet so they can continue to take testimony, because they are booked out for that whole 2.5 hours. As you might imagine, there's a lot of interest in sand mining in Minnesota, and so they have a lot of people coming to testify. And I imagine with all of us and all the senators for questions that we'll use all the time that we have. And then next week on Monday, we're going to be hearing from the Midwest, I'm not even going to try to say the acronym, MISO. And then on Tuesday, I have noticed that our hearing time will be extended, and we'll start a half an hour early. We'll do noon to 2 instead of 12:30 to 2, and then we'll come back in the evening on the 26th, beginning at 6. I expect we're going to be hearing our first sizable policy bill, and just judging by the amount of questions that people have and the time that it will take, I want to make sure nobody feels like they're cut off on questions and that we have a full opportunity to discuss it. So it's my hope that that would give us enough time. And then I'll go to minutes real quick. Representative Morgan, have you read the minutes?
Yes, I have.
Would you like to move those?
I will move the minutes of the February 12th meeting for adoption.
Representative Morgan moves that we adopt the minutes from February 12th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Garofalo, you have a question.
Thank you. Madam Chair, two questions. Number one, the joint hearing, are you going to be chairing it, or will the Senate be chairing it?
The Senate will be chairing that hearing.
Okay. Madam Chair, you might want to tell the Senate, probably a better idea if you chaired it. I think I'll certainly be on my better behavior if you're chairing the meeting versus the Senate, especially given the sensitive subject matter. It'd probably be in their best interest to let you chair the meeting. And Madam Chair, I'm not
Representative
kidding. I'm not kidding. I'm serious. So,
well, Representative Garofalo, I don't think we'll be discussing any particular proposals. I mean, like the overview we had today on RDF, I know people get a little bored with overviews. But I think the idea is to become better informed so that when the legislature starts considering proposals, which I presume there will be some on this topic, that we have better information. So I don't think that there'll be a need to be very contentious. Because we'll be receiving information.
Madam Chair, my point is not to be contentious. It's that members of the House on a bipartisan basis are much more curious, intellectually curious, than the passive members of the Senate. And their culture is not one where they are used to members actually thinking and asking questions during debate. And that's on a bipartisan basis. So
well, we have sent some younger and some good House members over to the Senate on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, but they're still senators, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair, my second question is, you brought up, do you have any, what bills are we going to be taking up, or what bill are we going to be taking up that you think we'll be moving?
I anticipate we'll be doing something in the field of renewable energy, but I don't want to preempt the author's introduction.
Well, thank you for narrowing the subject for this committee. We appreciate it, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo, I hope you will bring Girl Scout cookies to the floor to sell to members, because I think you do a brisk business over there.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you should know, members, my daughter's here selling cookies today, but there has been a run on cookies, so she actually might be cleaned out already. So.
No further business being before the committee, this meeting is adjourned.